So welcome to another talk, Dhamma talk here at Anuruddha Center. Again, as usual, we make sure that we use these really great teachings from a long time ago, but to apply them to our modern world so that we can lessen any problems in our life. Because if you didn't lessen any problems in life by coming here, if it made more problems, then there'd be something terribly wrong with what we're teaching here. It's one of the things with any sort of spiritual teaching, it should create a happier life for you. I know that sometimes people are saying, oh, well, we have to suffer now, and we'll get the paycheck after we die. If you follow the right religion or the right path, then you get your paycheck after you pass away. But that is a bit dodgy to me. How do you know you have backed the right horse? Which religion is it? But again, it didn't really make any sense to me, except when we started to have some wisdom teachings which made sense. And I'm sorry, someone's making a photograph. Oh, no, come on, it's okay to take photographs. It's the meaning of my life. Well, I've got to pose first of all. Come on. It's so weird, you know, when I was young, hardly anyone would take a photograph of me except the police. And I used to give flowers to my girlfriends, but now people give flowers to me. It's really weird. Anyway, where was I? Oh yeah, learning just how to do something useful with what we have in our life, and with especially spirituality. And this is one of the reasons why that, you know, if when you come here you get deeper meaning, but not just philosophical meaning, not just stuff which you could read in a book, but some which is really practical, it helps, it works in your daily life, then it is well worth coming here. Basically, what do you get out of this? You know, sometimes that people would call me, this one person used to call this me at this place, it was a Polish lady, and she asked me, said, how much do you charge for the meditation session on a Friday night? And I said, nothing. She said, no, you don't understand me, she said. How many cents, dollars, do I have to pay to get in? And I say, nothing, it's for free. He said, listen, how much do you have to cough up to get in? I say, nothing, it is totally for free. And then there was this wonderful pause, you know, when people are just trying to sort of work this out through their system. And then she asks, well, what do you get out of this then? And it's a very beautiful question. This is not for money. This is for something much more. It is for happiness, for peace, for joy. One place you can come without having to pay anything. Isn't it very beautiful? Of course, you have to pay to get out, but there's no entrance fee. No, you don't have to pay to get out either. Isn't it really beautiful that there's something here which is just for generosity? It's my giving to you, your giving to me. Just, it's a beautiful little interchange there. And there's very few things in the world which is done, you know, through trust, through joy. And for those of you who have the opportunity, you know, to actually to, you know, go to places like Dhammasara, our Bhikkhuni monastery, Nuns monastery, beautiful place, or to Bodhinyana monastery, another beautiful place, or come here on this weekend, and you'll see so many people bringing food, so much food, and they. I asked them, why are you bringing all of this? We've already got enough. And they say, no, we're bringing it because it makes us happy. It gives us joy. It is the joy of this beautiful interchange. You know, sometimes people would ask, you know, you're monks. Can't you stay in your monastery, nuns stay in Dharamsala, and just you've got enough land there? Why can't you just grow your own vegetables and just be self-sufficient? And then, you know, you won't be bothered by people bringing you all this stuff to eat and stuff to do. You could be just like hermits, recluses. But you know that is against our monastic rules. We can't even store food overnight. We have to have everything offered every day. And the Buddha put that in there because there's a really beautiful reason for that. What he was saying is, we need you. That's what the nuns are saying. They need you. Because without, we would starve. And you know that happened in the first years we were here? I was telling that to some of our Thai supporters when I started reminiscing about the good old days. In the good old days when we used to live in this little house in Magnolia Street in North Perth. Some of you may remember those days. It wasn't a golden age. It was a hungry age for me. Because sometimes people were so busy, there's only a few people supporting us. And they would, you know, they would actually bring some food and put it in the refrigerator overnight for us in the following day. But we couldn't actually open the refrigerator. You know, we couldn't sort of cook it up ourselves. We had to have somebody actually presenting it to us. And it happened quite a few times. I could see the food. I could smell it. But I couldn't eat it. And sometimes, quite often, people forgot to come. And we had to fast all day. That was tough. But it was good we carried on. You say, well, why do you do that? Because what we're saying is we need you. So the monastic communities and you, there's this wonderful synergy. The fact of being self-sufficient goes against kindness and compassion. It's saying, I need you, just like you need me. And that is a beautiful way of connecting with people. You know, that sort of beautiful act of sharing, we call it. Look, there's so many times, even tomorrow, I don't know if they're here right now, doing another marriage blessing with Dennis. He's not here at the moment, maybe too much, he's coming here tomorrow, so too much Buddhism may be a bit too much for him. That's what my brother used to say. My brother, when I was in London, I took him to a few of the things, and especially if there was food involved. He used to come along to this place, and the person who was feeding us, who was going to give us bangers and mash, and when my brother heard that, he said, oh yeah, I'm coming along as well, do you need a driver? I said, yeah. So he came along, and after he finished the meal, he actually, you know, he ate three meals a day, he ate more than I did. Incredible, must run in our family. But anyway, just on a tangent here, I've got another excuse for being a bit sort of round in the middle. Because you know that I take on so much responsibility these days, Mr. President. So many jobs which I have to do. I have so much weight on my shoulders, it actually squashes me. My real height would be about another 6 inches, and so you wouldn't be so flat. Have you ever squashed anything like that? It just expands in the middle. So that's one of the reasons why. It's not really too much fat, it's just, you know, sometimes... Do you believe that? No, you don't. Okay, I'll try another one. Because I gave a talk to the monks the other day, and it was actually true that when I was going through the customs, I travel a lot, I'm traveling again tomorrow, going through the customs, I think in the United States, you know, in a trip last June, I think, and they said, now what are you wearing under your robe, sir? And I say, is that a suicide belt? And I say, it's only fat. When I told that story to the monks, one of them said, well, it is a suicide belt. So it's not, it's just happiness. And it's just, but anyway, this is a wonderful joy in sharing. And this is the same, that this is how we can share with all the people in here. I get so much fun and joy out of teaching. Sometimes that's why you do too much. And people get a lot of joy and happiness out of bringing so much food to monasteries, or just being here and sharing and doing things together. It is a way of saying that we need it. You know, there was something which changed my mind so much years ago, was when I read an old story of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, when he wasn't very well known, when he was still living in Tibet. And there's a very old article. I wish I could keep these things, but you know, I'm used to letting go, so can't find them anymore. But I remember it very clearly. This article, a journalist was following, managed to get into Tibet, was following His Holiness Dalai Lama, you know, in Tibet before many people knew about him. And he would go from place to place looking after basically the people who were Buddhists in Tibet. And so he was going from village to village. And all these villages, a whole lot of very, very poor people sometimes, sometimes wealthy people, would line up to give him something. To give him something. And then the journalist was wondering, why are all these people giving you these things? And what really upset this journalist from the West was when a very, and obviously really poor woman came up to him and gave him one of her skirts. You know, not the one she was wearing, sorry, but I'm not going to be careful there. But, you know, one of the old skirts which she had, which was rags. And this journalist was so upset. He said, "What are you doing that for? You're a man. You don't wear skirts. And that woman, she's so poor, you know, she's obviously just, you know, just almost destitute. And you take a skirt, you know, from this poor woman, you should be giving her things, not taking. You're Dalai Lama, you live in a palace, you get everything you ever want. What are you taking this for?" Very upset. Now, one of the nice things with Buddhism, well, you know, if you really are a teacher, when somebody gets shouts you like that, you just calm. You soak it all in, and you diffuse the situation. When people get excited, you start speaking in a slow voice. It calms people down. It's just so easy. Sometimes I've got to be careful because it might send you asleep, so I can't do that too much. But you lower the tone of voice while you're quiet and allow the person just to calm down. And then he gave the answer, which was absolutely just mind-blowing for me at the time. He said, "It's true, sir. I don't need a skirt, but that woman needs to give it to me." And at that I thought, wow, now I understand what generosity, what sharing really is. It's not that he needs a skirt, but she needed to give it to him. That beautiful act of sharing and caring, being with somebody else. That is why I get fat. I don't need to eat all this food, but you need to give it to me. It is true. And how does it feel? You give me something, and I don't want that. That really is just a terrible, terrible rejection of an opportunity of kindness. She's not here today, Lakshmi's daughter, but this, I shouldn't really say the names, but she's passed away now, but I remember this Sri Lankan girl, woman, Lakshmi. Oh, you know, she was here from the very beginning, and you know, what do you get a monk for Christmas? Nothing. But what she did, she hand knitted a pair of socks for me. Christmas, summertime, 40 degree temperatures. just what you need. But I never said that. You know, I just, what are you doing that for? You know, can't you ask me what I want? That's not the point. So what she actually did, she gave the pair of socks to me just before the 7:30 meditation. What did I do? put them on, of course. Even though I was sweaty, itchy, really irritating, I don't like socks. Now, even you could, if you see any of my old friends from the time I was a student, I never wore socks, even in UK, during the winter time, even in the snow. You know, just, you know, people think I was weird anyway, but, you know, even more weird when I became a monk, but got really good circulation, so don't need socks, don't feel the cold. So anyway, I wasn't wearing, so I usually don't wear socks, but that day I wore them, and while I was doing my talk, you know, sometimes, you know, you don't sit perfectly still, sometimes I move around, so I was moving around as if I was getting a bit stiff, and I just put one of the legs out, made sure that she could see it. That is a wonderful memory, because she was sitting over about there somewhere, and in the corner of my eye, I saw her interrupt my talk. "He's wearing my sock! He's wearing my sock!" That was so beautiful. That's what you do these things for. Now, simply because the kindness, the generosity, that is so simple, but so beautiful. How we share things together. And so that's one of the reasons that why the, you know, the sharing, the giving, and also the receiving should be respected. And some of the other things which, the beautiful things which I've learned in monastic life, it's, you know, sometimes people need to share and give. Doesn't worry that it gets, doesn't get lost. Everything goes over to, if we don't use it here, it goes over to charity somewhere. There's always some people this time of the year that need to, have a little bit extra. I'm going to do an advert now. Because, you know, Armadale group. We have a small group in Armadale. When we, from Magnolia Street, we moved up here, people say we're moving too far north. So we've got a centre, not really a centre down south. It's our little Armadale group, meets in Armadale Kempscott Hospital. You know what they do every year? You find it on the web, I think. It's a low socio-economic area. So they just do a little collection of $20 coal vouchers. Is it Coles or Woolworths vouchers, oh yeah. Coles Myer, yeah, those sorts of vouchers. And so they give them to the women in the women's refuge so they can go and buy presents for their kids. Not actually just getting a present and say, "Here you are," but so they give them a little bit of freedom to actually to go and find something which you know, they want to get for their kids, and they're doing the shopping, they're in control, it's almost their gift. We're giving a little voucher for you to go and get a gift for the kid. It's really beautiful. I shouldn't have said that, because now they're going to get heaps of them now, but why not? You know, it's a beautiful thing to do at Christmas time. So don't get stuff for me. You know, it's beautiful actually to give it out where it can be really needed. Beautiful, a little bit of act of kindness and generosity, because all those acts of kindness and generosity which I have done, I don't know why I'm talking about this time, because maybe it's because it's Christmas. You know, even in people ask us, "Buddhist, you're a Buddhist, do you celebrate Christmas?" Yeah, of course. Why not? We asked Ajahn Chah years ago, asked, you know, "Is it okay we celebrate Christmas?" And he said, "What is Christmas anyway? It's a season of peace and goodwill to all human beings." This is of men. Not to, not really peaceful to turkeys. They should go hide somewhere during this time of the year. But peace and goodwill to all human beings. And so, he said, "Well, nothing wrong with that. Well, how do you celebrate it? So we give presents to one another." That's a good idea. So because of that, every 25th of December, when Ajahn Chah was alive, he'd come over and celebrate. He didn't actually call it Christmas, he called it Chris Buddhamus. That's what he called it, Buddhamus. Why not? All it was really we're doing is just like celebrating kindness and generosity towards people. And every time that I was in UK at Christmas time, it's just like Chinese New Year for Chinese-born people, that you go and visit your family that time of the year. Christmas is when you're supposed to be visiting your family, in the Western culture. So I remember just walking down the streets of London. I know a lot of times because they didn't know what the heck I was, you know, wearing brown robes and bald head, no socks. That was weird enough. But then you would people would never ever say hello to you. But on Christmas Day, everybody would say hello to you, without exception. You know, there's also that one time I recall that, you know, that to see, it's amazing, so the different cultures, but you wear these robes wherever you go because that's all you have. So anyway, when I was visiting, like Stoke-on-Trent, that's where my mother was born. There's a lot of family up there. So I was visiting, you know, one of my friends or cousin and over there, and going for a walk in the morning, a nice sort of bit of exercise. And as I was walking down the streets, everybody was pointing at me and laughing. And I don't mind actually creating some happiness in the world, enjoying this world. It's a wonderful thing to make people laugh, but I really couldn't understand why. I wasn't telling any jokes. It was just, you know, just my appearance was sometimes making them laugh, and I didn't know why. And when I turned a corner, I finally found out why everybody was laughing at me. Because there was a big billboard, a big poster, that the circus was in town. And I realized they thought that I was one of the clowns. But I don't mind as long as people laugh. It brings a lot of happiness and joy in the life. It's a good way of like connecting with people. So because of that, that it is a wonderful thing that we share. We share our lives, share our frailties, our faults. I was just telling in the last few days, because now the temperatures is going up in our world. It's not in our world, but you know, this time of year in Australia. You know, we have this holy water which we sprinkle on people. And now, you know why we do that? Sprinkling holy water, the ritual. It is because it cools people down. It's very popular this time of the year. And I remember, but sometimes I get into trouble with all these rites and rituals. You do it for a nice bit of fun sometimes. Kids love it this time of the year. Well, most kids. One down there doesn't. But I went to this lady, she's not here today, thank goodness. She lives not far away. Unfortunately, she'd lost her voice. And she couldn't speak, some, I don't know, bug inside of her. But so she invited me on the way here on a Friday. This was a couple of years ago now. On her way here on a Friday night, she invited me to, please, can you just pop by just to give me some blessing? I've lost my voice, can't speak at all. And it was true, like, she's just croaking. So I gave her the holy water blessing, and then about an hour later, I think it was her partner rang up. She said, she can talk now. And said, and I wish she couldn't. It was much better when she did. So he started scolding me. Don't do that again. I know you're just full of fun and games. But anyway, that beautiful sharing is very important. And it's also the ability to have a little bit of kindness and lightheartedness in the Dhamma, in the teaching, which actually increases people's happiness and well-being. Sometimes the people say, well, you know, can't you say something deep and meaningful? This is deep and meaningful. Sometimes you've got to change people's perceptions. Talking about when our monastery down in Serpentine started over 34 years ago. And over there people would come, and the first time we were there, and said, where's the monastery? And I was looking for buildings. And I said, this is the monastery. Where's the building? This is the monastery. It's the atmosphere, the people. That makes a temple, not the buildings. Always remember that. Because I now had enough education to know the meaning, you know the meaning of a church? It was never meant to be the buildings, it was the people. A church was a congregation of people. Nothing to do with buildings at all. But sometimes what happens, we just forget. And the church becomes the monument, never remembering it's the people inside which really matter the most. It's the people who come here, the atmosphere, the kindness, the joy, the fearlessness, the peace, the feeling that you're accepted and safe in a community. That is what is the most important. That's what makes a temple, a monastery. It's the people, never the things. And always recall that, because sometimes, you know, as a leader, so-called leader anyway, so that you try and emphasize what's really important in life. It's not the theory, it's whether it makes people happy and joyful. Even, you know, in our little meditation retreats, which, you know, that one which Ajahn Santuti is going to give next week. Yeah, he is Australian, but actually he was actually born in Indonesia, on an island on the way from Vietnam to Australia, a migrant. So it's beautiful that he's at our monastery. If ever any of you, he's always very smiley and very, very fun. And that's why he's very welcoming in our monastery. Very joyful. So anyone who will go into that retreat will have a wonderful, happy time. Just actually seeing a smiling monk instead of a serious one. You know, I don't know if you know this little anecdote, when Ajahn Chah first went to the United States, that's what people remembered him for. They said, "You taught us that it's all right to smile when you're meditating," because everyone else was just so serious. When I went to Hong Kong the first time and gave a talk in this old Mahayana temple, one of the nuns there, she thanked me afterwards and said, "Thank you so much. After you came, now I'm allowed to smile." And I thought, my goodness, what's happening in this world? If a person comes to a spiritual place and a person's not happy, now what is that teaching other people? And is it teaching other people that, you know, this spirituality, you come here just to suffer more? Or, you know, to have, you know, be told how terrible you are and how you're going to go to hell or whatever. I said, no, that's not the point. The point is allowing people to come here and be uplifted and giving meaning as well to actually how to create more peace and happiness in this world. Look, there's so many sort of little things about even when you meditate, you come to a place like this. If you go home and you're a worse person afterwards, then don't come here again. I say this because so many times when people have come to a place like this or come to do some meditation retreat with someone like an Ajahn Santuti or with Venerable Hasapanya, they go there and they come back a kinder person. I'm not saying how much wisdom they have and how much they can argue with people about the essence of Buddhism. Are they really happier, more grounded, more peaceful people? More sensitive people, more able to create happiness wherever they go in this world. If not, they shouldn't be coming here. They shouldn't be going on retreat. Stories, anecdotes. There was, in the very old days, there was this Australian guy. And he would come here on a Friday night, but he could never get the opportunity to go on a retreat, even for a weekend retreat, because his wife would say, "Darling, we can't spare you this weekend. There's so many things to do on this weekend. We've got to go shopping, you've got to clean out the shed, you've got to take the kids to sport. There's too many things going on. No, you can't go." So, he's, you know, a very sensitive guy. I said, "Okay, and I'll help." So the next time there was a weekend retreat, the same happened. "Can I go on a weekend retreat?" "No, you can't go. It's too busy. This mother-in-law's coming. We've got to fix up this. We've got to do that. The car needs washing." Okay. And so, every time there was a weekend retreat, he'd ask his dear wife, and she would keep on saying, "No, you can't go. No, you can't go. No, you can't go." But there's one important principle in Buddhism. Persistence. Keep on going and going and going. And that's what he did. And so about, I don't know how many times, you know, she said no. There was a weekend retreat coming up and said, darling, can I go on the weekend retreat? And she replied, oh, okay, you just go on your weekend retreat, leave me here with the washing up and the cooking and looking after the kids. He took that as a yes. And off he went. And she was a bit upset, but what happened was when he came home, he was such a beautiful husband to be with. You know, just one weekend, he was just like sending your car, you know, to be serviced. It runs much more smoothly afterwards. Okay, getting your dishwasher sort of serviced. And the next time he was on a there was a retreat being held, and this is honest truth, he told me he never needed to ask his wife. She gave him the money and sent him off. Off you go. Because it was just a wonderful change in people. Just the getting a bit of time out, a bit of kindness, a bit of good energy, a bit of happiness. It actually just brushed off on the wife afterwards. And so then she started coming. Or just like in that little Armadale group. There's, I don't know why it's there, because maybe people have more time to talk to me afterwards, but so many of those people who go there, they said this story repeatedly, you know, different women, and so said, I never felt like coming today. It was like on a Tuesday evening. It was just, I came home tired from work. And my little daughter, 5 years old, Mummy, are you going to meditation? And then, no, darling, I'm too tired. I'm just going to put my feet up, watch the TV. Mummy, you must go to meditation. Oh, I'm tired. I don't feel like it. Mummy, go to meditation. And she said, why? And the little kid would reply, because you're a much nicer mummy when you come home from meditation. Even the kids felt that. That's just a beautiful little anecdote. I've heard that so many times from different women. That, I don't know why women, send their husbands there as well. They come back a new, improved, much better product. So, if you're having trouble with your husband, send him off to Ajahn Santuti's weekend meditation retreat. It works. Or if you're having like trouble with a boss at work, if you've got a boss at work, do a collection up amongst the staff and send him off to a weekend meditation retreat. It actually works. And people become very calm and peaceful. Even here, just, you know, I'm going off to do a retreat over in, teach a retreat in, it's just going to be in Penang, sometimes in Singapore. Some of these retreats, you know, I found, I don't mind saying this, it's the, you know, the psychiatric emergency team over here in Perth, PET team. Anytime there's a big, big problem, they can come out and just sort it out and help out. But I saw they were on a retreat, one of my retreats. I think that was over in Thailand, I think they were. And they said, what are you doing here? He said, look, it's so stressful, you know, working at the forefront of, you know, psychiatric disease, mental illness. We come here just to relax, to get some peace, to go back so that afterwards we can serve so much more effectively. I know sometimes it would be wonderful if we had more retreat centres, more people teaching, more opportunity for people just to chill out. You know, you have Christmas holidays, what are you going to do on those Christmas holidays? New Year's holidays? Go shopping? More stress? Where are we going on holidays? Having to queue up in line to say, is that a suicide belt under there, sir? Checking everything, made to feel like a criminal because, you know, or a suspect. So, when you do all of those things, waiting around a long time, so isn't it wonderful just, you know, to be able to do a nice little calm, peace and quiet, nice retreat? Unfortunately, we're all full up and booked up. I shouldn't really be saying this, but you know, a little bit, do a bit more peaceful meditation. It really, really helps and works. And I was saying this also because I promised there was a kid coming in before year 11s, year 12s, university examinations. Look, so many times I've taught this little story and an anecdote from my own experience, because I've got to live my talk. You know, you can't just say things and don't practice them. That makes me feel just a big hypocrite. You can't do that. I just can't live with myself if I don't practice what I preach. So this particular time, that's university. And you all know I went to a posh university, you know, Cambridge, in theoretical physics. It's one of the toughest subjects. And in those days, we had what was called final examinations. After 3 years of studies, everything was down to one set of examinations. You passed or you failed. Everything else you've done in the whole 3 years counted for zip, nothing at all. So the pressure was on you. 3 years could be wasted, or you could be successful. The pressure was really on. My teachers, the professors, my family, all told me, you work hard. You get a good degree. Imagine a good degree from Cambridge University. That will set you up for life. That was so much. Go, my young. I have to say that, because go, my young is a party word for bullshit, which I'm not supposed to say. What good did that do me as a Buddhist monk? If only I knew I was going to become a Buddhist monk, I wouldn't have worked so hard. But anyway, I never knew that, so anyway, the pressure was on. So, the exams, in those days, 3-hour exam in the morning, hour for lunch, 3-hour in the afternoon. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. 6 days in a row. That, I should have complained to Amnesty International, to the human rights. I mean, that was torture. You know, series of exams, one after the other, it was terrible. But I had my advantage over my friends. Because the first exam, a 3-hour paper in the morning, they had 1 hour for lunch. I never had any lunch. Instead, I went back to my room, had a big breakfast, had a big dinner in the evening, still a student, not a monk. And what I did was at lunchtime, I went to my room and sat down to meditate. This was in 1972. Sat down to meditate. And you know what happened? As soon as I sat down to meditate, closed my eyes, I started thinking about the morning exam. What I'd done. Did I answer the questions correctly? Was it right? Was it wrong? Should I have some more explanation? What a waste of time that was. Thinking about an examination which was already completed, which I could not change. It was finished. It was done. Why worry about it? It's logical, isn't it? But it takes training to let go of things which you can't change. The past. It's finished. It's like an exam which has already been completed. Good, bad, pass, fail. It's gone. Cannot be changed. Why can't we let those things go? As for me, I practice. I learn how to let things go. So, you forgot about the morning exam. Whatever happens, can't change it now. So as soon as I let go of the past, you know what next happened? The future! An exam in quantum physics coming up in half an hour's time. Ah, do I know enough? But again, all that worry and the stress were taking up so much energy. It was draining me. I realized even when I was only 20 at the time, that now is the time you're making your future. If I'm worried, and if I'm draining all my energy now, what energy would I have left to actually do the paper in the afternoon? Zero. So I could actually let go of the fear of the afternoon exam. I've got to prepare. Preparing means not thinking about it. Being in this moment. So that was actually where I learned the benefits of not letting go of the past, letting go of the future. Because now was really important. So, next thing I did, I noticed, and I was really concerned about it. This is another part of of just how these teachings tell you about how to be healthy. Because I found I was shaking, physically shaking. Nervousness. Now this was, I was brainwashing to thinking this was important. Now I know much better. But those days, I thought exams were the be-all and end-all of life. And in fact, I remember just one of those pieces of graffiti they had on the wall. They had really good graffiti at Cambridge, really, high standard graffiti, much better than at Oxford. I'm messing around. Calling the exams kill by degrees. And I thought that was really cute, exams kill by degrees. So, very good, thank you. At least somebody appreciated that. But, you had to do those things. But I was nervous. I was shaking. And what really concerned me was I never noticed that. I always assumed, I had this idea, I was a very relaxed, happy-go-lucky person. But, my own image of myself was not the reality when I was actually in this present moment and under, a lot of stress, actually shaking. But, as soon as you're aware of what's going on, as soon as you can focus on that, it's easy to fix up. It's just as soon as you find out, in the car, what's wrong, or, in the electric wiring, where the mouse has actually, eaten through the cable. Once you've signed the problem, it's very easy to fix up. So as soon as I realized I was shaking, it was very easy just to be mindful and just to relax. Just focusing on the body in this moment until all the shaking just stopped. The nervousness was gone. And the last thing I noticed was even more concerning. This was actually the physical health. How? Because you're not noticing the signs that there's something out of balance. You don't know how to deal with it. That's where you get a lot of physical problems. But the last part was the emotional problem. My brain was just so tired. I'd just done a 3-hour exam in something like Astrophysics of the Galaxy or something. A cool title, but really hard work. And so, what it meant was my brain had sucked dry of all its energy. And the only simile I could use, because I was born in England, was like a tea bag, which had already been used, and you try and brew another cup of tea out of it again. It's just got no energy left, no oomph left. It's just like trying to make a coffee out of coffee grounds that had already been used. And that's my brain. It was just so depleted in energy. But the other thing I knew, once you can see the problem, you just relax. And the thing I said last week in that simile of I don't think I said it last week, but I say it very often. When you can relax and be still, you get this big boost of mental energy. It's as if, that to charge up your iPhone, you've got to sort of, not turn it off and plug it in. Keep it still. Don't use it. And then it just recharges by itself. And that's what happens with your brain. If you're always using your poor old brain, thinking, worrying, concerned, controlling, doing stuff, that's why your brain gets incredibly tired. So you just relax it, let it be. And then just after about half an hour, my brain was just totally recharged. And the anecdotes of my friends, they said, I went into the afternoon examinations with a smile on my face. They said that was weird, I was the only student who was smiling in the afternoon final exams. And they thought I was cheating. That's what they said afterwards. Well, sort of cheating, but not, allowable cheating, because I had a little trick no one else had. And so I've taught that technique for a lot of people. And it was just a few years ago. You can check this up. It was at Carmel School, the Jewish school here in Perth. They invited me just before year 12s. And I gave those similes. And I got a letter from the principal afterwards that year saying we got the highest scores of all the schools in Western Australia that year. Thank you. I don't know why they never invited me back again. But, maybe because the word was out while they won. But this is really important. This actually works. So this is learning just basic skills of what we know about sort of our meditation's whole tradition, which actually makes you learn how to be do the things you have to do in life, do examinations, go for interviews, play sports, whatever it is. a little bit of meditation, calming, then it actually works. You know, you just know all the time that how people have your abilities, but because we tense up, that all the abilities tend to go out the window. We don't know how to relax. If there's anything which we can teach you here, is how to relax to the max. I was giving a talk in Netherlands about a few years ago. It was some high flyer CEOs stuff, you know, I think it was in a yacht club somewhere down there. And just after giving the talk, I always remember this executive, an old time, I don't know who she was, but she came up to me afterwards and said, "I've just been watching your talk, and you know, you really are, you do actually live what you speak. Because just right now, there's a reason why I remember this, because my robe fell off." And he said, "You're just so loose, so relaxed. Even the way sometimes you sit." And she, unfortunately, she went to a Catholic convent where all the nuns were so tight. You know, just almost trussed up like sort of sausages. I don't know if that's the right meaning, but please excuse me, but that's just what came up in my mind. And so tight, and just the whole thing was tight as well. So just being able just to relax a little bit more. A bit of laughter, a bit of joy. Now that is not just superficial. That goes to the heart of our world and our life. Because when we learn how to relax, it's amazing just how many of those examinations in life you can pass. Whether it's going for the autopsy, no, not the autopsy. It's amazing what comes out of your mouth sometimes. Autopsies are great, don't feel a thing. Go the biopsy was what I was doing. Why the biopsy? Okay. Why do they actually call the coroner? The coroner is someone who investigates death and coronary unit. You know, in a hospital where you have hearts and stuff. Anyway, I don't know. Anyway, just when you go for bio, you're really afraid, or you go for something you're really, really afraid. Why do people actually do that? It makes things much worse. So just relax. When you learn how to relax, whatever you have to do in life is just so easy. You can pass exams. You can actually do really well in whatever career you have to do. When you have your wedding ceremony, you can just relax. It's supposed to be the happiest day of your life. Still remember, because we're doing a wedding tomorrow with Dennis, that somebody actually, this is true, they came up to me afterwards and say, "You know, your marriage day is supposed to be the happiest day of your life." I said, "Yes." She said, "Is this it then?" She was really disappointed. Yes, it's all downhill from here. Oh no, I was only joking. No, you can make happiness anywhere, no matter what you have to do. And that makes you incredibly successful, whatever you want to do in your life. Learn to relax and be happy. And the last little piece of advice, don't ever worry what other people are thinking about you. Because people these days are far too busy. They haven't got time to think about you. So you can do whatever you want and have a happy Christmas. Sadhu, Buddha, sorry. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okie dokie. So, we have some, any comments from here? Do you think that if ever we needed to raise some more money for our temple, I can actually get a job over Christmas as Father Christmas? Because I'm the right shape for it. With a wig? No? Father Christmas? In coals? Okay, maybe. I don't know. Anyway, From Germany, Ajahn Brahm. I was in an abusive relationship for a few years. My body goes into shock and fear every time I have to be by him. How can I feel secure by someone that is dangerous? Look, if it's so you have been in an abusive relationship, of course, you know, you move out of that relationship for a few years. Every time you have to be by him, can't you just move away a little bit? Because, yeah, later on maybe, you know, that when your body is healed and you feel safe, you know, the presence of that person doesn't trigger, you know, those memories. So, it's the thing to do is, first of all, move away. And otherwise, it's very hard to feel secure by someone, you know, who you remember in that particular way. However, there are so many other people who aren't abusive. So, you know, if you've got a car, you know, which is not working properly, do you keep driving it? No, you actually, you know, usually send it to the dealers and get a replacement. So, can we not get like a husband replacement shop? Defective models, you can take it in. Wouldn't it be wonderful if they were under warranty? because not all people are abusive. We always focus on the ones because they cause so much problem in this world. There's so many sort of wonderful people out there. So, the best thing is to find another partner if you possibly can. And you know, if you can't even find another partner, be by yourself. There's nothing wrong these days. You know, I remember saying this in a seminar on marriage in the Guild in UWA some years ago. And when I say, well, marriage is fine, but you don't have to. You're not compelled these days, you know, to be in such a formal relationship. Especially with, you know, many women these days, you can be single. And there's nothing wrong with that. You're not considered to be sort of like on the shelf, unwanted, unloved, like a defective product, like you would have done, you know, sort of 60 years ago. So you have this wonderful freedom of choice if you want to be single. Wonderful. You know, you can have same-sex marriage, but I want to go to the next stage to have no-sex marriage. Is that a good idea? Anyway. But now, why not? We have this beautiful, instead of actually worrying what other people think of you again. So please get out of an abusive relationship if you're in there. And, but if it's maybe someone that's difficult to get out of, it's maybe your father or your mother. Because, you know, you can separate from a partner, but your father or your mother or grandparents, uncles, sort of, you know, it's very difficult just to separate from. But at least you can move away, keep some distance. And eventually, you know, it's amazing, just people do change. And people can sort of ask for forgiveness, but obviously you've got to be very careful. So anyway, from Norway this time, how can I stop thinking about something? I feel like I'm stuck in a thought pattern due to social anxiety. How do I frame my mind? How do you stop thinking? Be aware of the space between my words. In those gaps, you're aware but not thinking. And how peaceful it is. The more you notice silence, the space between the thoughts, the space between the words, the more that you value it, the more it grows on you. And soon you don't want to spoil the silence with the thought. So this is how there it is again. The silence between the thoughts. The space between people. It's not something which separates us. It's something which surrounds us, envelops us, embraces us. The space between things. Not to be looked upon as negative, but beautiful. The oceans don't divide the nations of our world. It's what joins us. The air is again not what divides us. It's what I'll be flying through tomorrow on my way to Malaysia. Look at it on a different way. Space, stillness is gorgeous. So, due to social anxiety, after a while, again, that's worrying what other people think of you. The other story about what other people think of you, social anxiety, is when you are in your 20s, roughly, you're very concerned what other people think of you. So that's why you have to dress well, you know, speak the right language. I think somebody told me, a lady's word was, embarrassed that, I'm not supposed to, something which you heard today. About sort of how you're supposed to speak when you're young. I mentioned one of those words the other day, like Nanya. That was last week, Nanya. That was this, for those of you who don't remember what I said last week, this at a retreat, one of these mothers, she said her son, maybe 14 or 15, when he was taking out, he was supposed to be doing his homework, said, "Are you doing your homework, son?" And the son said, "Nanya, mum." And then, "Have you tidied up your room? Nanya. Have you taken the trash out? Nanya." I didn't know what the son was talking about. "What do you mean, Nanya? What does Nanya mean?" "It's short, mum, for none your business." So that was a wonderful little word, Nanya. So, Nanya. None your business. But anyway, just this modern speech, anyway. So, how can you stuck the thought matter and social anxiety? That when you're in your 20s, you have to learn the right speech to be cool, like right clothes, you know, to look attractive. When you're in your 40s, like, you know, some of you here, you know, you don't dress up anymore. You know, you just, you know, you dress up really daggy, and you don't really worry if you've got sort of, you know, a bit of hair, you know, as a girl. You don't worry other people, because in your 40s, you know, you've got your self-confidence. "Oh, they like me a lot, don't like me, it's, you know, it's not for you." And apparently when you're in your 60s, you finally discover after all that time that people weren't thinking about you anyway. So where's the social anxiety? Just relax, enjoy yourself. Well, I just remember that just when I was out, you know, trying to find a girlfriend. You go and see a girl and you get so worried about what you say. You know, you want to go impress them or to do something and get all, you know, messed up. And then afterwards, she forgives you and then you start talking. She said, "Yeah, I was worried what I was saying because I was worried about messing up too." Certainly crazy people. So just relax and just whatever. So that tells you how to stop thinking about something. Is don't worry about other people thinking about you. Just and learn how to listen into the silence between the words. Lastly, from Chile, Santiago. "My parents raise cattle for meat industry. It's receiving things from them, breaking the precepts. I love them and worry about their karma. If you can possible find another profession, it'd be good. But sometimes, you know, you can't do that. Sometimes that, well, we're just trying to do our very, very best, and that's maybe just that's all the things which they can do there. So I love them, I worry about their karma." But, you know, sometimes we can't judge a person just because of one thing or two things or three things which they do. You know, because sometimes you see all the other beautiful things they do. You know, sometimes, remember that story of the two bad bricks in the wall? You know, sometimes you see two bad bricks in the wall, the first wall I'd built over in monastery, and I was so upset about it, I wanted to destroy it, and it made a mess of the wall. But it was the 998 other bricks which were important as well. So what about all the other things which your parents do? Your parents didn't just raise cattle, they raised you. Did they raise you for the meat industry? Of course not. So, you know, you love them, they're very good people and try their very, very best. You know, there's this last little story I say last little story many times, as many last stories. Usually I have three last stories before I let you go. Ajahn Chah's story. This one of his close disciples, it was featured on the BBC documentary many years ago. It was Poor Um, his name was. What was the name? A great little guy. And he was so poor that when he had faith in Buddhism and he sort of wanted to keep the five precepts, he said, what can I do? Because, you know, I have to catch fish, feed my family. I mean, he really was dirt poor. You know, just basically no money, just, you know, you made something and you bartered it in that economy, you know, 40 years ago in northeast Thailand. And so what Ajahn Chah did, he said, well, look, you know, catch enough fish to feed your family, but don't, you know, catch extra to sell them. And in the meantime, I will teach you everything I know about herbal medicines. Because in those forest monks in those days, that was, you know, part of the training, to learn about every herb in the forest, because there's no doctors. Now, you were alone, by yourself, no Medicare, no ambulances. If you got, you know, bitten by a snake, you had to, you know how to deal with it. Every monk had to know that. And also the herbs in the forest. So Ajahn Chah just learned that, like every monk of his generation would have to learn, and was quite an expert. Unfortunately, all that knowledge has mostly been lost now. But anyway, that he would, Ajahn Chah would taught this man, Poor Um, about herbalism. And he became so good, little by little, became the herbal doctor of the village. Very highly respected, and so he never needed to catch any fish. He had a profession. And I thought that was a very beautiful, practical way. Yes, it's wonderful that, you know, that it's not the best that your parents raise cattle for meat, but maybe you can teach them another profession. You know, little by little, so little by little they can do a better job in the future. But, you know, they're probably really good parents, kind parents, so don't just focus on one or two sort of bad bricks in their wall. They obviously raised you, Lucia, and so wonderful, just keep things in perspective. If you can do better, wonderful. Okay, so any questions from here? From Perth? No? Okay, I know the question many of you want to ask. Can we go now? Okay, so we'll now pay respects to the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. And then we can just, whatever you need to do.
Arahang Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavanta Abhivademi Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami Sukhatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namami.